Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today we speak with Canberra polyglot poet Anita Patel, also the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Anita Patel lived in several countries and cultures before settling in Australia, and that's reflected in her poetry, more specifically in her multifaceted poetic voice. Her collections, A Common Garment from 2019 and Petals Fall from 2022, both appeared from Recent Work Press. She has presented her work at such venues and events as the Canberra Multicultural Festival, the Poetry on the Move Festival, and the National Folk Festival. Her poetry has appeared in such publications as Cha, an Asian literary journal, Cordite Poetry Review, Australian Poetry Anthology, Volume 8, and the Australian Book Review's States of Poetry ACT 2018. When I and my colleagues, Peter Searles and Peter Monahan, welcomed Anita Patel to the ArtSound Studios recently, we began by discussing an article she published in Femme Asia titled A Yoke and a Gift, Life Without a Mother Tongue, and her fascination with language.
It is one of my primary things. I have had an obsession with words since I was very, very small. I grew up with quite a few languages around me. I grew up speaking English, but then Malay on the side, kind of simultaneous words coming into my being as a small child. And my father adored English. Both my parents adored the sound of English, adored reading English. And so I was brought up around a lot of English. I was also brought up I was born in Singapore, and then we went to London, and then we went to Singapore, and then, you know, back to live in Singapore. But in between that, we'd be in and out of Malaysia, which is basically very similar to Singapore in many ways, mm-hmm. and then migrated to Australia. So I guess I've been around a lot of different ways of English being spoken. That's kind of tuned my mind and my heart in, you know, so much of what I love is about words. That essay came out of a sudden realization that despite all of that, and there's been so much talk about mother tongue, particularly around migrant poets, I realized I didn't really actually have one, but I have a multilingual voice, if there is such a thing. There is a type of multilingual poetry going on in Australia, but it is not people standing up and speaking a poem in their own language, per se, for an audience of other people viewing that and not being able to understand that language. More, it is poets who have a multilingual voice in the English that they write. And of course, when you've grown up in all in the colonized countries that I've grown up in, and in England itself, you realize that you're picking up all of the nuances of colonization and sound and stuff. So like I said in that essay, I can slip very easily from Singlish into Cockney. I went to school in London, and we lived in Kew, or in Ham, near Kew, but I went to school in East London, and it was a, you know, Catholic school and stuff. So it was supposed to be a posh school, but really there was so much good East London around me. So I can slip into those different voices really easily. And then I can do you a very flat Pauline Hanson as well. It's very easy for me to hear an accent and pick it up, basically because it's a survival technique. When you move from country to country, those of us who move as children learn to really speak quite very quickly in the voices of the new country. It's the quickest thing for a migrant child or teenager. The quickest way you can actually assimilate is to gain the voice. It doesn't matter really how you look. If you can start, you know, speaking like them and saying stuff, talking about footy and stuff like that, you will be fine. And picking up the colloquialisms and slang, and we do it, many of us just do it very, very quickly, just so that we can fit in.
Isn't that interesting that it really often is about how you sound? it seems to me then that you have different languages and then you have different Englishes too. And what a gift for a poet to have that kind of access, that kind of resource just deep within you.
Yeah, I've never thought about that being a poetic thing, but it is interesting because, you know, Kim Scott, who I do quote in that essay, I actually had a little quote from him, and I just wanted to, I did bring it because he does talk about it being like poetry, you know. So he actually says in writing True Country, he felt like he was writing in the language of the colonial masters, I think. And he said there was this slick surface of language, but he said, fortunately, some of my characters spoke a version of what is termed Aboriginal English. And then he said, I wrote it as one would poetry, attending to rhythm and syntax. Mm. And when I read that, I thought, oh, yeah, we do. Languages do affect the way we hear rhythm and absolutely, the way we write syntax. And I know when I read your poetry, Kimberly, I often can hear that American sound in there. And I love the American poets have always been my very favorite. So I can hear that voice, that sound in your poetry. I can, you know.
What are some of your favorite American poets?
Okay. So I William Carlos Williams, my absolute, you know, go-to. Ted Kuza. I love these kind of poets. Linda Paston.
I can see that.
These are my poets, you know. And I only came across some of them quite recently. Mm. You know, I of course love Walt Whitman and all of those people too. But yeah, definitely, yeah, some of those lovely voices that just tell truths, you know. I bongo with my lingo and beat it like a wing, yo.
To combo, to Colombo, can't stay your type, my bing, yo. In speaking of all these languages, there's one poem I was going to ask you to read because of the way that words are used in it, sound is used in it. It's, I think, the title poem, right? Queda de pétalos? Fall? I know it will be hard to capture the spacing on the page.
It is. So this poem actually is my attempt at writing a Panera Peroso poem. Panera Peroso poetic form was actually a rare, like it's an unusual form because it was developed by the Cristang communities, which are the Portuguese Eurasian community of Malaysia, then Malaya, and my grandmother comes from that community. The way the poem is written is that they're just the words are supposed to have fallen on the page like petals. So another word for these type of poem is queda de pétalos, and it's like supposed to be the aesthetic breaths of the poet. And I'm sure I've broken all the rules of it. I think you're supposed to only have so many words per line. I'm pretty sure I tried to keep to that, but, you know. So that's the style. That's the form of the poem. The words in it are all Malay, like the words that aren't English, except for jingli nona, yo kere kaza, which I guess it's almost the anthem of the Eurasian community. Yeah, you can look it up. It's called Jingli Nona. If you Google it, you can hear a YouTube sound of it. It's a Portuguese song, Portuguese Eurasian. And so we dance to it and I could just grow up singing. Yeah, it's like the soundtrack to Eurasian households. Queda de pétalos, fragments of a Eurasian childhood. Soft as kabaya lace, fragrant as cayumanis. Sweet as pineapple tarts. Jingli nona, jingli nona. Twilight thrum and twang. Yokere kaza. Singing voices, dancing feet. Find Nanny's rosary beads, girl. Fetch the city box. Tea and cake with Atas cousins. Itchy pokey party frocks. Twirling branio, drenched in holy water. Spiked with sambal belacan. Dark as ketchup on boiled rice. Funny as Uncle Sarong dropping. Sting of rotan on backsides. Auntie's slipper flying. Clatter of mahjong tiles. Guitars strumming. Hantu everywhere. A saint for any occasion. So many people at the table. Eat some more. Makan lagi. Amor, minya, amor. Amor, minya, corazón. cuerda de pétalas. All those petals falling, falling, falling.
It's like you're setting the words free in little bursts. Yeah. It's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I've always looked at it and thought, oh, no, I don't think I can.
No, you can.
I salt and pepper my mango, shoot spear at the window, bingo, good I'm in the bingo, now what I'm doing my bingo.
From her polyglot, polycultural perspective, Anita Patel's poetry often registers encounters with an Indigenous Australia that not many Australians know.
Yeah, that's such an interesting thing because I haven't ever thought about it like that. But I guess my favourite place in Australia is Broome. And I came to Broome quite a few years ago. My daughter was living up there for a few years and her husband worked for the Kimberley Land Council. So we'd go up and have months up there. And I had never been to Broome. And suddenly I came to this place in Australia where Indigenous and Asian Australia were absolutely intermingled and absolutely primary in this place. And white Australia just seemed to be a tacked on periphery, like in the way that it should be, given its tiny, tiny history in this country. In that place, it was. You know, when we migrated, you'll have a fit when I tell you where we migrated to, because we migrated to Cronulla. Now, I don't think there is a whiter enclave of Australia. And if there was anywhere that was going to have a race riot, it was going to be that place. Mm. Having said that, I never encountered overt awful racism there, but that's a whole new story. But the Broome thing is interesting because I was like, oh, I've come home in Australia. And in that time, we also did a lot, Alice Springs and Kakadu and all that sort of stuff and all those sorts of places, Uluru. But I thought, oh, Aboriginal Australia is so similar. Aboriginal communities in Broome are so similar to Eurasian communities in my country, in Malaysia. The Malaysian Eurasian community is so, so similar to an Indigenous community. And my cousins can pick up guitars and just play songs. Everybody's an auntie, everybody's an uncle. There are people, you know, the aunties are throwing a slipper at you, you know, all of these things. And I was like, this is kind of a home space for me without me wanting to intrude into claim any understanding of Indigenous culture or intrude into that place, but just that feeling of, you know, yeah, that. So I guess the way I maybe wrote about them is from that space as well. I think in Common Garment, there's a poem about we went into the John Flynn Hospital in Alice Springs. And so we were in Alice Springs and, you know, they said, oh, you know, do a little tour of the town. John Flynn Hospital, that's the place to go. And I'm the child of post-colonial parents. I mean, I grew up with all of this, you know, independence of Malaysia, independence of India story all around me. And I walk into the John Flynn Hospital and here is, you know, John Flynn, the good white doctor, doing his good things and these Christian ladies giving us tea. And at the back of the hospital, they'd given a tiny space to this Aboriginal woman and she, for her art, and she had paintings up. And I just found myself getting out of that whole hospital bit and going and just being with her, and mm-hmm. she took us into her country, you know, and I just think I just couldn't connect with the white history of Alice Springs, but the Aboriginal history, that was, you know, that was intense, mm-hmm. like to have that.
I like fish and mango pickle. When I climb trees, then feed them pickle. I'm broke this month, didn't pay rent. I had to jump town and the money's all spent, all spent.
So in a sense, your poems denaturalize Australia in a very constructive way, I find.
Oh, that's such a generous thing to say. Thank you.
I'm also thinking, too, about the title of that book, Common Garment.
Yeah.
And that idea of what inherently you're feeling in common with this other culture, that there is no other.
There is no other. I think that notion of there is no other is so... I mean, especially at this time when we're, you know, considering really a moment in our history that could really do some interesting things to this country. I think that when you've been in so many different places from childhood and in so many different family spaces, because I married an Anglo-Australian and he's from Goulburn. So, you know, it's interesting because I think he found it really kind of exciting and interesting to come into our family. And for me, and people say, you know, well, how was it and everything? And it is a cultural shift to go into another space, into another type of world, another type of family. And when you're very young and you're doing that, when you're first married, you don't think about it much. And remember, I had had my teenage years in Cronulla. So I had really kind of built this little armour of Aussiness around me. So I was, you know, I was good with it. But as I've got to this point of my life, I've realised, yeah, it's a shift to go into any new culture and it changes who you are. But it also reminds you that otherness is such a constructed thing. I think that's really interesting. One of my cousins actually said to me, she said, you know, we were like Clayton's migrants because we came and so in Cronulla at that time there were no people except white people. It was the most vanilla place. It was still white Australia policy when I came to this country. And they only allowed in Asian professionals, particularly doctors. So my father was we migrated. There, my auntie's family migrated because she's a doctor. So there were about 6 or 7 Indian families, all doctors. I remember a white school friend saying to me, so are all Indians doctors and teachers? Because their wives or their other spouses had to be a professional. My mum's a teacher, was a teacher. And I said, they are. It's just like, just put you out of your misery here. That is who we all are. So that's where I'd grown up, you know. So I was really ready to have this. Yeah, it was interesting. So I think there's a poem in Common Garment, Don't Be Afraid, which is about that time. And it was interesting to me, you know, because I see now everybody knows what a laksa is and everybody's trying to make roti canai off, you know, MasterChef and everybody's into all this Asian stuff. And there's a kind of interesting reverse of cultural appropriation where I'll say to someone, oh, I'm going to Singapore, you know, or I'm just going to Singapore for a holiday. And Australians, white Australians, will tell me what to do in Singapore. And I'm like, okay, thanks. You know, because we're all very well travelled and we know all these things now. When I came to this country, I remember a kid in my class saying to me, so where is Singapore? Is it in Africa, you know? And that's 1971 Australia, you know. It was a really different place to what it is now.
If you think about how far Australia's changed, the way that you use multiple language in your poetry, it's natural. It's just that is your world frame, whatever.
Yeah.
And it is of a lot of Australia, a far more of Australia than a lot of Australia really has come to grips with.
Than the monolingual. Yeah. I think it's very interesting in Australia because I think Australia, especially after Whitlam, I think, was the first world leader to really put in a multicultural policy into their country. So Australia has really, you know, sort of embraced multiculturalism, but it's a kind of descriptive multiculturalism. So it's, you know, we love to have your food and we love to see your costumes and we love to watch you dancing. And, you know, and if you think about the multicultural festival, which I love and I've performed at, my children have performed Indian dance at and sort of things, you know, all of that sort of stuff. But where is the Anglo performance in the multicultural festival? It isn't there. And the reason is because the dominant tribe, the Anglo dominant tribe, are the audience for multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is descriptive in this country. whereas I grew up in a truly multicultural, multilingual country as a child, there are words I don't actually know the word for in English. I know it in Chinese. Yeah. I know it in Hokkien or in Cantonese or in Malay, but I would never say that word in English. And we're constantly, all of us in Malaysia, whether we're from Indian background, Chinese background, you know, Malay background, we're mingling English with all these languages and in Singapore and Malaysia. But in Australia, we're so multicultural and we're so aware of multiculturalism, that descriptive multiculturalism, but we have remained absolutely steadfastly monolingual in the way that the country actually operates. What they say is, you know, you can go and you're very welcome to have your beautiful Italian language or your Hindi or whatever at home. You do that, but the language of this country is English. And if you are going to succeed in any art form, in any way in this country, you have to be able to speak English. Mm. And the reason I was going to say, my cousin said we were Clayton's migrants, is we came speaking English, because as in that essay that I wrote, I don't have a mother tongue. English is the language my parents spoke to each other because they didn't share a language mm-hmm. except that of their colonial masters. My grandparents also didn't have a common language. So we speak English. And so my cousin said, we just blended in. Like, we could just fit in. And in fact, you know, probably copped less racism than a lot of Italians and other groups that didn't speak English when they first came to this country. But the English that we speak, and I think the English that's in the poetry and the poems, is claimed by heritage. So it contains our cultural history, our narratives, the sound of our languages, and like often the words, as you say, where they just slip in. I think I recorded for you a poem called Your Voice, which was about my mum and my grandma's recipe books. I don't know how to say those words in like a lot of those, like sambal belacan, I don't know how to say that in English. There's no English for me to say those kind of words.
Let's hear that poem.
Your voice. I riffle through your voice in fragile pages of old Malay exercise books, stained yellow as nicotine fingers. Fry spice till you feel like sneezing, and when that first tickle comes, add asam, salt, and kusum leaves. Then mix together 3 teacups of second milk from a freshly grated coconut with ground chilies, onion, and ginger. How much ginger? Just 1 piece, the size of your thumb. No use pointing out that my thumb is bigger than yours, or that I will be pulling ring tops off cans of coconut milk from an Australian supermarket. I will not be pounding spices in a mortar and pestle. The buzz and whir of a coffee grinder has replaced the dogged thump of stone on stone in my kitchen. But the faded ink of your voice speaks long forgotten words, held somewhere in my mouth and heart. Bawang, Blachan, Serai, Jintan. Nomadic syllables wafting among the pots and pans, sizzling the air with their fragrance.
So many of your poems do mention cooking.
Yes.
That's part of the same sort of dynamic, isn't it, of cultural mixing.
Yeah. My parents were amazing cooks. Even for a culture that cooked well, they were extraordinary. I have not, that missed me, like, you know, it misses a generation. And then it went to my daughter. My mother was a tour de force, and she just said, you know, this fete they're going to have at the school. And we all went to Catholic schools. We're very devout. Not me, but mum. Mum said, we're going to do curry store. And we would just die. Like, we'd just be like, oh. And the first time they did it, it was like, the people came. And every year from then, in Cronulla, like, people, all these Anglo, you know, white people would stop. Are you having the curry stall? Are you having the curry stall this year at the, you know, like, they would just be waiting for this food. So, so this is a little bit, this is based on that. Aunties. Fete day. Balloon burst of sky stretches bright over asphalt. And stalls spring up. All the old favourites. chocolate wheel in pride of place, under powdered drifts of wattle blossom, sweet-scented as coconut ice. Always the same setup, that's how we like it. The mum's new-permed, summer frocks swirling, the dad's in shirt sleeves, a squadron of megaphones. The children everywhere, lolly spittle, sticky-lipped, screaming. An hour to the grand opening. And the aunties arrive. Purple, saffron, peacock green, a gaudy flotilla. Kohl eyes flashing, dupattas flying, sandals flapping, rapping out orders as we follow behind. They billow and jangle, a rainbow tangle across the asphalt. We slink along in hipster jeans, halter tops and platforms, and feel the eyes, hard, blue, burning, bright like the Australian sky, on our brown-skinned backs. I'm bloody not serving their stinking curry, mutters the bravest of us, and we make a break for the lucky dip. An hour later, munching on sauce-soaked snags, swinging on the arms of our Aussie mates, pulling strings of spitty stick-jaw sugar a foot from our greasy gobs. We notice a spicy waft of vindaloo and kofta in the air. They are eating it everywhere, even the blokes from the sausage sizzle and the blue-rinsed Lamington ladies. Bangle brandishing, ladle dipping, bazaar bantering, the aunties dance gleefully. Subcontinental witches stirring their cauldrons.
A couple of your poems in that book mention the sky in striking ways. The balloon burst of sky.
It is extraordinary to a migrant, the sky, the Australian sky. And I remember my father. So my father is Gujarati, but he actually is born East African Indian. So he was born in Kenya, and their whole family really identify very strongly with Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania and those sorts of places, but particularly Kenya. And I remember Dad coming here after being in Singapore, and we sat in on a bit of grass in Cronulla Park or something, and he looked at the sky. He's like, just look at this sky, like for him. And it was, I think, a reminder of that East African sky, you know, that blue. And but for Australian sky is a very bizarre, beautiful thing. Now everyone's travelled, so you've seen the sky everywhere else. But for us, you know, coming, it was extraordinary. It's just, yeah, it's a beautiful, yeah, sky.
And it's funny, I noticed that too. I think as a poet, when another poet takes something that's been written about literally countless times, the moon, the sky, the sunset, and can show it to you in a new way.
Yes.
It's yes. So exciting. And so I have noticed also the way you depict the sky.
That's the glory of poetry, isn't it? Being able to take something we see every day and then just like make us, like just through that refreshing or startling metaphor or image, just make us see it again. Yeah.
Next week, we'll continue our conversation with Anita Patel. She tells us about her multiplex religious upbringing and says more about her place in a multicultural Australia and much else. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. On Monday, October 9 at 7 p.m. at Smith's Alternative in Civic, That Poetry Thing presents Anne Collins and Karina Vanonen. Anne Collins is a Hobart-based poet whose most recent book is titled Listening to the Deep Song from Bright South Press 2022. Karina Vanonen has been writing and sharing poetry for 4 years across Canberra in work that centres on the themes of radical hope, uncomfortable despair, and a collective spirit. On October 16 at Smith's Alternative, recent work reading presents Brent Cantwell and Lucy Alexander. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. The music on today's program is from Sri Lankan Indian English musician M.I.A., including her contributions to the work of the Wilcannia Mob. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid. Jump off the bridge.
put it in a fridge.